You're listening to the Mint Editors Podcast with me, Nandita Mathur, and Mint's consulting editor, Sandeep Khanna. So we take the telecom story first, where this week we had Anil Ambani's Reliance Communications and the deal with Aircel falling off. It didn't work out. And exposing Reliance Com to a lot of risks in the terms of its debt repayment plan, because they have a huge debt of 45,000 crore. So what does this mean now?
So let's just roll back a little bit. Arcom's debts obviously didn't come about in the last 6 months, in the last 1 year.
Yeah.
They've been mounting over the last many years. And in fact, the attempt at selling off assets to repay part of its debts is almost about 10 years old now. They've been making various efforts to do that. Unfortunately for the company, not too much success. And the latest blow of the proposed deal with Aircel, it's they had to call it off because they couldn't basically go to the regulator in time.
That's it.
So, you know, there are two aspects to it. One is the implications for Arcom itself, which is actually just much worse than the situation they are in at this point of time. But far more significant is the implications for the lenders to Arcom, because, you know, they are now up against a wall. There is only so much that they can do, and Arcom's already talked about, you know, putting up a lot of its other assets on sale, including their real estate, including their towers business. The problem, of course, is that, you know, whatever assets they try to sell now, they will suffer from the hangover of, you know, the fallout of the Aircel deal. They have been talking to Brookfield for selling off their towers business. But again, that was something that was incumbent on the Aircel deal going through. So there'll have to be a revaluation of that deal. And, you know, at some level, they will obviously suffer on the valuation there as well. They've also talked about selling off their real estate, which is fairly large in terms of the number of acres that they have in many of the cities, including Mumbai, where they have this huge land bank, as they call it. But, you know, they're going to be, I mean, it's going to take a lot of time, and their immediate, you know, they have a moratorium on their interest payments till December this year. And as part of the agreement now, they will have another about 12 months after that to start with, you know, to pay off their debts. But, I mean, just to put it bluntly, it really seems like a fairly complex and fairly difficult situation for them. I would hesitate to call it endgame, because at the end of the day, it's a large enough company, and, you know, they do have assets which they are, well, at this point, desperately trying to monetize.
What does it mean for the spectrum? Because that's also coming under renewal, I read.
Absolutely. So, that actually, that's you know, that compounds their problems. They have spectrum which they've in, you know, they've said they want to sell. The unfortunate problem is that a lot of their spectrum was bought much earlier. In fact, probably was responsible for much of the debt that they've mounted on their books. And that, I think, that's just got about 2 years to go now. And you know, so at this point of time, there are only two possible buyers for any spectrum, Jio and Bharti. And I don't see them buying, you know, spectrum which expires in 2 years from now. So that's putting
it is a big blow for Arcom.
Big blow is right. Well, Arcom and, like I keep saying, the lenders, the lenders, you know, and the other ones.
Right. Moving on, SEBI, the Securities and Exchange Board of India's panel on corporate governance, led by Uday Kotak, has just come out with its, you know, proposals to enhance capital markets and, you know, sort of enhance fairness and transparency
among,
you know,
companies.
So, among companies. So do you think these measures are going to do the needful?
Absolutely. I mean, whether they're going to do the needful, the fact is that we needed a panel of this kind. There have been numerous instances of, you know, issues related to corporate governance,
especially
issues among boards. Absolutely. I mean, actually, it's been going on for a long time. If you know, one of the provisions of one of the recommendations of this committee, for instance, relates to the role of auditors. Now, if you actually look back, one of the biggest corporate scams in India, you know, the Satyam scam, it happened because in some ways the auditor at that point of time did not do its job, even if we assumed that they didn't, they were not party to the scam itself, but they didn't do their jobs. So, you know, we've had holes in corporate governance standards in India for a long time. And to be fair, you know, SEBI has been trying to plug them. The government has also been trying to plug them. In fact, you know, in April this year, you know, there were norms issued on how companies should be putting together their corporate governance issues. And, you know, this committee in June, which was, I think it was constituted in June, it was a follow-up to that. And, you know, they've given some specific recommendations, and those will now be opened up to the public, and, you know, we'll have another 3 months to debate over those. course. Mm. Now, whether that's going to, you know, stop all kinds of corporate malfeasance, we don't know at this point of time. And also whether all of them are viable, again, it's a little debatable. For instance, should we be specifying how many board members should be there, or should we leave that to companies? Those are fairly relatively, you know, probably slightly trivial issues. But the fact that we needed these norms and that companies should at some point of time be adopting them, and the best companies should probably, you know, be doing that on their own without waiting for these to come through. For instance, there's a small provision about, you know, separating the role of the chairman and the managing director. Now, India's largest companies, you have this concept of CMD. That's prevailing even in the public sector.
True.
You know, so that's something that I think a lot of companies should, any case, be taking cognizance of, you know, moving towards. So, yeah, I mean, most of the provisions seem to have been thought through. Remember, it was a very large panel, about 21 members from across the board. They had people from, you know, academics, they have people from proxy advisory firms, and of course the corporate sector itself. So, yeah, a lot of sensible suggestions in there.
Right. So it's possibly a step in the right direction.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the maturity of a capital market system finally depends on how companies behave when nobody is watching, let's put it this way. So, you know, watchdogs can do only so much. But when you have these norms in place, over a period of time, even the smaller companies then get used to, you know, working in that way.
Right. So moving on, we had another report on the e-commerce industry, basically on startups. This was some data released by Traxen, which said that only 800 startups have been launched this year as compared to 6,000 in 2016.
Right.
You know, so that itself is a staggering difference.
Absolutely.
And of course, the reasons cited are that, you know, there are a lot of players struggling, the big players are struggling, there are a lot of startups which are closing down.
Right.
You know, funding is sort of drying up, and there's a general slowdown seen in the e-commerce sector.
Yeah, it obviously, it's a worry. The sheer numbers have dropped. The volume of the deals also is down. Although the amount of money that's gone in has actually gone up, but that's because of a couple of large deals, both from SoftBank. I'll tell you what I, you know, what my take on this whole thing is. 2014, 2015 were these, you know, rara years when money was just flowing in and everybody wanted to set up a little e-commerce thing.
Yeah.
And I think the villain of the piece is this word e-commerce, you know, because it seemed like such an easy thing to do. You assemble a couple small warehouse somewhere, put together, go, then you start selling, you know, you need a little bit of funding. But, you know, what we've seen in this year in particular with Snapdeal and a couple of companies like that going under, it's not an easy business, you know. It gets more and more complex as you get into it. And obviously that's made the investors more wary. But there is a positive side to it, which is that we are also seeing, you know, a change in the whole attitude of the startups themselves. They're conserving cash. They're not, you know, money is not flowing as easily. Of course, last year, e-commerce grew only, what, 15%. And the first half of this year was, again, bad. We discussed this last week. But, you know, the festival season, I think, has given a boost to e-commerce sales. But, you know, increasingly now you have startups in other spaces. You know, fintech, for instance, is emerging. In those, what you have is you have more discerning in founders, and the cash requirements in those are much smaller. So you know, a lot more people move into that software as services, for instance, I think that's one area we're seeing startups move into. Again, not very large requirement in terms of capital, more discerning founders. Not everybody and his uncle can set up a fintech startup, and that's probably healthy for the environment. I expect that in a year or so, once the e-commerce, you know, wave comes back, we'll probably see, because the capital is there, the money is there. We've written about it. There is enough and more money with the investors. It's just that they're not finding the right, companies to put that money into. So the match has to come through at some point of time. It will.
Also, this week we have the Under-17 Football World Cup. In fact, starting today, and India is playing in a global tournament for the first time.
Absolutely.
It's also hosting it. So do you think a young team like India can sort of pull it off with all the big guns of football playing together?
Yeah, I mean, so India is playing this tournament because it's hosting.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have qualified otherwise. They haven't ever qualified for a major FIFA level tournament, soccer tournament. In 1950, they were invited to the Seniors World Cup, but they couldn't travel because of whatever financial reasons. So it's a very strange paradox. I mean, soccer is very popular in India. I mean, if you not so much in the north, but certainly in the east, in the in the south, even in states like Goa, I mean, every little kid is playing soccer, and you know they all support teams from other parts of the world, Real Madrid or you know Barcelona or people like that. But somehow we've not made the jump from local soccer.
I guess we've been eclipsed by cricket because the whole focus is on cricket.
That's true. It's an interesting point because actually, if you look back, I mean, the real impetus for cricket in India came with the 1987 World Cup that happened here, the Alliance World Cup, as it was called at that point of time. After that, you know, the money started flowing in, the advertisers got involved, sponsors realized that you know you've got a huge television audience watching this game, so you could put your product out there, and I think that's the one thing that this this tournament could do for Indian soccer. The money would start coming in. You know, it becomes a viable career, not just for the players, but also for clubs, for you know companies. Teams that get into it and companies. I don't expect India to, they're not going to win too many games. They have three games and the three opponents they're facing, Ghana, Colombia, and the US. They, you know, Ghana has won the tournament twice in the past. The US has qualified 14 times for this, although they have a fairly poor record, but you know they have qualified. They have the experience of that. And Colombia is another very strong team. So it would be difficult for India to win a game, but it'll really, you know, perk up if the performance is good, you know, and the crowds get excited, they get behind the players. They're young kids, you know. So they'll start seeing a future career. In the, because one of the problems in Indian soccer has been that a lot of young footballers who have the talent and are probably very, very good, their ambition is just to play for a local club. And it ends with that, you know. I'll just get a livelihood, I'll get a decent amount of money. It ends with that. So, you know, a tournament like this, we've seen people like Baichung and Sunil Chhetri saying that I would have given anything to play this tournament when I was young. So that's the kind of excitement that we need for, for the game. It's, it is, after all, the beautiful game.
Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at Live Mint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. The Editor's Podcast is also available on iTunes and audioboom.com. Please click on the subscribe button on iTunes to get weekly updates of latest episodes. Thank you for listening and see you next Friday.